Good afternoon, everyone, and we will resume this afternoon's council meeting. Welcome. Do we need to call the roll since we just took a recess? Okay, let's do.
Sure. Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman? No, Hales.
Here. So before we begin, as it happens, there's a memorial service this afternoon for a wonderful community activist who I know a number of you in this room knew and who made Portland a much better place. We're here to talk about protecting the things we love about Portland, and Barbara Walker loved trees and trails and parks and spent much of her life as an activist in this city creating what was originally called the 40-mile loop, but of course now is a lot more than 40 miles. And I'd just like to take a moment of silence, but hopefully we all smile and we remember that she lived a long and good life and passed quietly and made Portland a much better place. So a moment for Barbara Walker, please. Thank you very much. Okay, Carla, would you please read the item before us?
Item 1331, amend building demolition code to require notice and delay for all single-family residential demolitions in areas with a residential comprehensive plan map designation and make other changes.
Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor Hales. As we all know, at least most people do, the Bureau of Development Services administers and enforces the state building code throughout the city. Currently, the demolition delay ordinance requires notice and a 35-day delay in issuing demolition permits for single-family residences in areas with a comprehensive plan map designation. There is an exception to the notice and delay requirements when an applicant files for a building permit to replace the home that is being demolished with another single-family residence. The code currently allows neighborhood associations to request 120 days of delay for no particular reasons. On July 30th of this year, the Historic Landmarks Commission presented its annual report to City Council, and that report included recommendations that the City Council should take action to reduce the number of demolitions of single-family homes with historic significance. Based on the Historic Landmarks recommendation, I directed the Bureau of Development Services staff to work with the Development Review Advisory Committee, henceforth known as DRAC, which established a demolition subcommittee. And we added members of the Historic Landmarks Commission and the Design Review Commission and asked them to work hard to present a proposal to the City Council by the end of the year. We've got a full day. There's another hearing tomorrow, but we indeed did deliver on that promise. And I want to start by thanking all of the volunteers and the staff who have worked on this project for your diligence in coming to this proposal before us today. The Demolition Subcommittee did reach consensus on proposed changes, and that's what's being presented to the Council today. With that, I'd like to invite staff and volunteers to come and tell us about it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Nancy Thorington with the Bureau of Development Services.
I'm Andy Peterson. I manage the Plan Review and Permitting Services for BDS.
Jeff Fish, Chair of DRAC.
Thank you. So basically, what we did was we worked with the DRAC Demolition Subcommittee, the Historic Landmarks Commission, and the Design Review Commission, as well as members of the public, to come up with amendments to the Demolition Delay Ordinance. We're recommending amendments that will amend the notification requirements, the delay provisions, define demolition, and add a new permit category for major alterations and additions. We really tried to be inclusive in this process and have as many stakeholders as we could. I went out and did a lot of outreach into the neighborhood associations and got them to bring representatives so that we could have as many voices at the table as we could. Even though everyone's not necessarily happy with all of the provisions that we're proposing to the council, we think it's a pretty fair proposal that's before you right now. And I personally would like to thank everybody who was part of this process, including the DRAC subcommittee, which worked really hard, the members of the public, and everybody who attended the meetings and participated. So with that, as Commissioner Fritz noted, on July 31st, the Historic Landmarks Commission came before the council with their annual report, and it included a white paper that had some recommendations about residential demolitions. They recommended first removing the current exception to demolition delay and notification so that all residential demolitions are subject to a 35-day delay. They recommended codifying a definition for demolition. Right now, there is no definition either in the state code or in the city code for demolition. BDS basically just uses a policy that's been in place for a while. And then the third recommendation, and as part of the codifying that definition, they wanted it to include removal of 50% or more of the existing building. The third recommendation was to create a demolition task force that would be composed of BDS and Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff, as well as other stakeholders, to address changes to Title 24, which is the building regulations, as well as changes to Title 33, which is zoning, and to the comprehensive plan. So based on that white paper and the testimony, I sat in on that hearing so I could see what the public was concerned with. We worked with the demolition subcommittee and came up with the proposal that's before you right now. So we met several times between August and November to discuss these various changes. So I think we had enough input to get to this point. The first thing I wanted to address is what we didn't cover, because there were a lot of things that came up at that July 31st hearing that people wanted to, that are related to demolition, but we didn't cover them. And to understand that, it's necessary to look at what the BDS authority is. Basically, we regulate what a building looks like. I'm sorry, what a building, the health and safety of the building, the fire and life safety, is it going to, you know, fall down, burn down? But what we don't legislatively have jurisdiction over, because that's under Title 33, the zoning code, is what gets replaced. Things like, you know, the lot coverage, you know, how tall is the building, what does it fit in with the character of the neighborhood? Those are the kinds of things that we don't look at, and therefore we didn't address things like the context and the compatibility of what was going to the replacement structure. We did not cover the historic resource inventory, the loss of affordable housing, tree protection. There is a tree code that's going to come into effect at the beginning of January, so that's covered by that anyway. And then the one area that we didn't cover that I know there's been a lot of public discussion about is the hazardous materials, the asbestos and the lead-based paint. We, as a city, lack regulatory authority over those matters because the regulations are in state law or in federal law under the EPA. Those matters are regulated by the Department of Environmental Quality, OSHA, the Oregon Health Authority, through the Contractors Board. So we have no regulations, so we can't go out and cite somebody for, you know, not cleaning up the asbestos or improperly disposing of the lead-based paint. We just don't have the authority to do that. We have been working with DEQ and OSHA representatives trying to address it. We realize that there's an issue with it. And so they're the regulatory agency. So we've sat down with them and tried to come up with some outreach and education and materials that we'll be able to hand out. The representative from OSHA has been very helpful with us, and he's going to be developing a handout that we can give to applicants for demolition permits that will basically have the asbestos regulations for DEQ, OSHA, you know, federal regulations, for asbestos on one side and lead-based paint on the other that we can hand out to applicants. We did change our building permit application. I know in some of the materials it said, well, this is just a notice, but that's not true. It's actually on the building application, and it requires the applicant to sign to say not only I acknowledge that my project may be subject to asbestos and lead-based paint regulations, but also that if it is, I will comply with it. So it's more than just a statement that, yeah, I get this project may be subject to it. There was some things in the material about some other local jurisdictions. One of them was Tualatin, and it said that they require an asbestos survey. I went on to their website. Yes, they do require an asbestos survey, but for commercial projects. 1 to 4 unit residential units are specifically exempt from the asbestos survey regulation. So, yes, they do have the requirement, but it's not relevant to what we're doing here. Hillsborough has a checklist, and it basically says for information only, and you just check a box that says, yeah, you may be subject to asbestos and lead-based paint. Lake Oswego does require a certificate of compliance, and I spoke with the staff member there, and she said that they don't do anything. They do no regulation. They don't inspect. They don't go out and to see if anybody does anything. Again, it's just they have to have somebody say that, yeah, we know that there's lead-based paint or asbestos there. So I just wanted to, you know, get that out there because I know it's a big issue, and understandably, because, you know, if things get kicked up and they're not dealt with properly, that is a hazard. So with the recommendations for under the white paper, the first one was removing the current exception to the demolition delay notification. So the proposed amendments do eliminate that exception and would make all residential demolitions in the residential zones subject to a 35-day notice and delay period. The second recommendation was to codify a definition of demolition as the removal of 50% or more of the existing building. The proposed amendments don't define demolition that way. They define demolition as the removal of the entire superstructure, basically down to the subflooring. But what we did to address what have been referred to as the virtual demolitions, where, you know, two of the walls come down, was to create a new category, permitting category, called major alterations and additions. And that would be defined as if you add a new story, if you increase or replace 50% or more of the exterior wall on any floor, so that covers that 50%, adding a total new floor area of 800 square feet or more, and that 800 square feet basically comes from, that's the ADU number. If you get over 800 square feet, then, you know, you can't, it's not an ADU. That's an accessory dwelling unit, sorry. And then if you're adding any new floor area that exceeds 100% of the existing floor area, and the purpose of that is if you had a house that was under 800 square feet, like 750, and you doubled it, that would still be a major alteration. So those would all be subject to, under our proposal, a 35-day notice and delay period. So you would get that notice, which is what the neighbors have been saying that they were concerned about. The third one, the creating the demolition task force, basically was, you know, beyond our purview. So if that's what the council directs at this point, then that's what we would do. So I'm sure the people here will say, definitely the most controversial aspect of this ordinance is the 120-day extension. So right now, the way the code is, it's a 35-day delay, plus you can ask for not just anybody. It has to be a recognized organization, which is, the Neighborhood Association or the Neighborhood Coalition, can come to BDS and say, we want 120 days beyond the 35 to the purposes to try and find an alternative to demolition. So that came in 1990. What happened was all the ordinance the way it was before that, all residential demolitions were subject to a 35-day delay in notice. And then in 1990, as part of a zoning code amendment, the Planning Commission recommended to the council that they add this 120-day delay. And the BDS director at the time opposed that because she was saying, well, this is subject to abuse. If you have people who can just come in and ask for a delay with there's no burden of proof. They don't have to show anything. They just come in and ask for the delay. She said there are other areas in the code that address this. So she recommended, she said, if you're going to adopt the 120-day delay, then I request that you also include this exception, which is now known as the K1 exception or the one-for-one exception, which allows if the applicant is coming in for a demolition permit and they're also going to replace that demolished structure with another new single-family residence, it's a one-for-one exchange, then they are not subject to the delay or notice, and that's the way the code is right now. So, and a vast majority of the residential demolition permits fall under that exception. But I think it's important to note that they came in at the same time because they were one was offsetting the other. So, basically, at this point, the DRAC subcommittee is recommending on that 120-day exception that it be removed and be replaced with requiring all demolitions to have all residential demolitions to have the 35-day delay, and then having an optional 30-day extension. And that basically would require both the property owner and whoever's requesting the extension to sign it. So it's voluntary, and we recognize there's no teeth in that. One of the purpose is to encourage the negotiations. We found, after looking at the statistics in the last year and a half, of all the residential demolition permits that were subject to the 120-day delay, it was used 8 times, and in none of those did it result in a house being saved. So the houses that have been saved were not under a 120-day extension. If you think about it in real estate terms, 35 days is a long time in a residential purchase. Sometimes, you know, it's hours you have to get an offer in. This gives the parties 35 days to decide if they're going to come to the table. What it doesn't do is cut off how long their negotiations are. They can negotiate as long as they want. The voluntary 30 extra days is kind of like a good faith, you know, agreement that they're at least going to stay in the negotiations for that much longer. Because if the owner signs that, then it is tied up for that extra 30 days. The issue is if you make all demolitions subject to the 35-day delay and you keep the 120 in there, you're going to have, you know, potentially 300 of these permits subject to a 155-day delay. And, you know, at the end of the day, if the owner's not going to come to the table and negotiate, they're not going to come to the table, and all you're doing is you know, tying up the development rights if they've otherwise complied with the code.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What's the situation that you anticipate where a developer would sign the 30-day extension as opposed to just agree to informally continue the negotiations? In other words, what's the incentive for the developer to bind himself or herself for the 30 days?
It's a good faith. It's a good faith representation that they're planning to do it. We don't know how it's going to play out. But hearing from the developers, they seem to think that was acceptable.
Okay.
So, you know, in coming up with this alternative, we really looked at a lot of different options. I mean, we didn't just, you know, toss out the 120. We looked at doing it in increments of 30 days with certain thresholds. We looked at, you know, different time frames. The problem that we kept running into was that if we started doing these increments or these different thresholds, we'd have to make determinations. And so it would have to be BDS staff, or it'd have to go to a hearings officer or some other option like that that would pretty much put us in like a land use kind of discretionary action. Plus, how are we to know what's good faith? So because of all of the complicated issues with trying to do it in steps like that, we rejected, you know, that as an option. We spent a lot of time on the 120 days. That was probably the issue that took up the most time, I would say, in the whole process. The other thing that we looked at that we are recommending changing is the notice. There's a chart that's in your packet, and it highlights the notice changes that we're looking at. Right now, all that's required for the demolitions that are subject to the delay is notice to the recognized organizations and a posted notice, those orange, you know, notice of intent to demolish posters. What we are recommending is adding a mail notification that BDS would do. It would go to the site addresses within 150 feet of the property and to the recognized organizations within 5 days of the completed application. And that would kick in the delay period. We're recommending getting rid of the posted notices based on input from the development community that those are more of an attractive nuisance. It's like, hey, this place is vacant, you know, come and squat here. And there's enough statistics to back that up that actually is happening. So we removed that and replaced it with door hangers, which we think are a little more effective. So they would go to the doors of the surrounding properties so that anybody who's actually living there would get notice within 5 days, you know, 5 days before. So if they had issues or concerns about the asbestos or the lead-based paint or closing their windows or covering their cars, then they would be able to do that. And those would be self-certified, which is similar to the short-term rental situations. And then, again, the extension, the 30-day voluntary extension. And then with the major alteration category, that the notice for those would be self-certified email notices to the recognized organizations and the door hangers that would be posted at least 35 days before the work is going to begin. And with a major alteration, I mean, you know, any one of us who owns a house could be engaged in a major alteration. So we were trying to balance that kind of work so that, you know, I mean, you can notify your neighbors with a door hanger, but you don't have to, you know, go out and do a lot of mailed notice or things like that. But at least gives your neighbors a heads up that a large project is going to be underway. One issue that we tried to tackle was deconstruction. That was a big issue that came up at the July hearing, and we recognized that it's a very important issue, especially for Portland. We have worked with representatives from BPS, but basically it's a really complex issue, and we felt every time we started to go down that road in one of the meetings, the meeting started to go down a rabbit hole, and we really weren't getting anywhere on anything else. And given our time frame and the complexity of the issue, plus the fact that we didn't have the right stakeholders at the table, we didn't have any deconstruction experts. We had, you know, somebody from BPS, but we didn't have anybody from the construction industry there. And the other issue that's a little different with deconstruction is it's mainly an incentive program. And what we're looking at here with the demolition ordinance is more regulatory. You know, you can do this, you can't do that, you have to do this notice. Whereas with the deconstruction, it's much more of an incentive. Like, you know, you're not going to tell people you have to deconstruct. It's more, if you deconstruct, you get this. And so to really come up with a fair and comprehensive way to address this, we are looking at continuing on to discuss it. Jeff Fish here, who is going off of DRAC at the end of the year, has volunteered to continue on any subcommittee that might go forward in the future. We've had a few other people, some deconstruction experts, volunteer to do that work. So we're looking to come back, you know, maybe with something by the end of the fiscal year on the deconstruction. So we wanted to just make sure that you realize that. I'm sorry.
Still thinking of in the incentive vein of things with the deconstruction?
Yes, we didn't know of any. I don't know that the council, unless you tell us otherwise, I don't know that, you know, regulation saying you shall. I mean, the only regulatory part of this, if you will, would be a definition, but that doesn't have to be in the code. It can be, but it doesn't have to be.
Well, it's more of a Bureau of Planning and Sustainability issue that would be addressed in the comprehensive plan process. It's not a matter of us just setting a regulation with no policy to back it up. So that's where that discussion would take place, is under the comp plan.
Seems like I don't want to digress, but that seems like a strange fit for a comp plan. Anyway,
well,
go
it's
ahead.
Title 33 stuff, yeah.
Right. Sustainability.
Okay, so the other issue is just so you know is the fees. The current notification process costs about $800 to $900 a year for the posters and the mailing. So adding in the mailed notice to the surrounding properties will add quite a bit more to that. We are figuring on about 315 demolition permits a year at about 105 per permit for that staff cost. Yeah.
Correct.
Yes. For staff costs, that would be a total of $33,075 a year. The mailed notice, it would be about 95 a year, which is what it is now. So that would not be a change. The door hangers would be basically printing costs, and that would be about 630 a year for a total of about 33,800 for our proposed notification for the demolitions. And then adding in the major alteration piece, that basically is just going to be the cost of printing the door hangers. We estimate that the number of permits that would fall under this new category would be about 3,500. And so the cost for those printing costs would be about 7,000. So the total combined notification cost would be about 40,800 if you subtract the current 800 that we're doing right now. It would be a new cost of about 40,000. Right now, we are not looking to raise the fees. We were, if this is the direction the council gives us and you adopt the ordinance with these notification provisions, then we would take the next 6 months and see whether we can absorb those costs. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and turn it over. I know Jeff Fish wanted to make some comments.
Maybe before you do,
yeah, sure.
And maybe I want to ask you, Jeff, and other DRAC members that are here to sort of appreciate you going through each of these particulars, but talk a little bit more about the context for this. And that is, I think most reasonable people would say there's a house that ought to be preserved, and most reasonable people would say there's a house that ought to be, it's okay to demolish. We might differ a little bit on that, but I'm starting with that premise. And then I also believe that we're not adequately preserving all of the houses that most people would say should be preserved. Some of the houses that most people would say should be preserved are being demolished. And so there are things we can do, if you will, on the back end of the process, which is what we're here about today, in terms of controls over demolition that will maybe influence how often that happens, how often that goes the wrong way. And there are things we can do at the front end, which we do need to address in comp plan and code about what's the setback and the height and the mass and the scale of what can be built on a single family lot, how many lots can be split, how many can't. So my question is, how much more can we do on the back end of the process, and how important is that versus making changes on the front end of the process? I think we have to do both, but I'm trying to weigh that. I'm trying to understand, are we sending a whole bunch of perverse incentives to your colleagues who are builders and saying, in our code, it really says tear this house down, and all we're doing with this demolition delay stuff is damage control. If you really want us to stop tearing those houses down, change the code. I want you to opine about those big picture questions, because we do have work to do soon on the comp plan and the code that says you can't build a house that's three times the size of the house that you demolished. So I'm interested in that bigger picture understanding from people in the room that care about this, because my sense is we're going to talk a lot this afternoon about the very particular details of how long the delay is and those things. But if you say, as you just did, if Nancy, you just reiterated that that 120-day provision has been implemented 8 times and it didn't stop demolition,
correct?
Then I guess I'm wondering if we're focusing on the right, if we're pulling on the right levers here. So I'm not articulating that terribly well. We've had a long day today, and I think it's showing because I didn't say that as well as I would have liked. But I hope you get the point, which is there's a front-end set of incentives and disincentives for what you can do with that old house. And we tell the development community, in effect, go ahead, or no, you don't, at the front end. And then at the back end, we say, so it's your intention to tear down this house. We're going to make it harder for you in this situation, and we're going to maybe make it easier for you if you recycle the components of the house. I'm trying to weigh how much the front-end incentives and disincentives will change the outcome versus how much the back-end, if you will, penalties and delays will change the outcome.
You want me to start with that?
If you could. Sorry,
I'll start with that before my remarks. First of all, in the 42 years I've been building this city.
Put your name in the record. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Jeff Fish, chairman of DRAC, also owner of Fish Construction Northwest. In the 42 years I've built in the city, the setback codes and the height codes have changed very, very little. So if I go out and build a house in a neighborhood that has a bunch of vacant already lots in there versus build a house in a neighborhood that's completely filled up with lots and I demolish one and completely fill up with homes, I demolish one, I'm not really building anything different than I would build between the two different neighborhoods. The difference, I think, is that the neighbors recognize that maybe the house that is demolished had maybe a little farther setback because it was sitting on two lots versus sitting on a smaller lot. So heights, widths, setbacks, stuff like that really haven't changed in the code very little in the 42 years.
But the market has, right?
Market in what way?
For what people want to buy.
Yes and no. I mean, up until the 90s, we didn't build on 25 by 100-foot lots. It was just kind of a unique thing. And now we see a lot of that, and it's acceptable housing for a lot of people. My view of what the problem is as far as guys demolishing homes in established neighborhoods is the lots underneath them and the cost and the difficulty of getting raw land brought to a lot basis. And I'll give an example is Renaissance Development. When I met Randy Sebastian, owns Renaissance, in 84, he was doing infill spot lots in Portland. Over time, he moved out the suburbs and started building on subdivisions and building his product out there. He's moved back in. He's now back being a competitor with me because the cost of land and the cost of the entitlements to get on that land are such that it dinged him really bad in the recession. So he'd rather come back and build a home on and tear down a house and build a home on two lots in a nice neighborhood. So a lot of the dynamics, in my opinion, is the dynamics of what metro and urban growth boundaries done to us. I haven't built a subdivision, per se, for years. All mine's been spotlight buildings. So in answer to your question, I think the front end, the problem for most of us going into neighborhoods is the land supply. And as far as the house being bigger, historically, houses have gotten bigger. The houses we all live in are pretty much bigger than the houses our grandparents or our parents lived in. And I know my parents' house was bigger than my grandparents' house. And it's a free society. If somebody wants to live in a large house, I don't see any reason we should stop them. You can't also try to dictate whether this home, if a spec, is going to have a six-person family versus a two-person family in it. So that's a hard thing to pigeonhole, in my estimation.
Thank you.
Let me make some additional prepared remarks, and I'll try to edit these because a lot of stuff Nancy already covered. The subcommittee from DRAC consisted of myself, and I'm on DRAC representing the home building industry, Mary Helen Kincaid, vice chair, representing citywide neighborhood interests, Steve Hyteen, former DRAC chairman, representing the home remodelers, Claire Carter, representing neighborhood coalition land use committees, Rob Humphreys, representing small business, and Rob has a permitting service. He helps people get permits, so he was really valuable far in seeing both sides of the issue. And Christopher Kopka, who represents historic preservation. Additional to what Nancy discussed, through the efforts of Mary Helen, Claire Carter, Justin Wood of the Home Builder Association, myself, Robert McCulloch, president of Eastmoreland Neighbor Association and treasurer of Southeast Uplift, and Dufay, executive director of Southeast Uplift, we met for lunch early in the process to discuss the demolition issues that were occurring in the city, and most notably at the time, the issues that made the press in the Eastmoreland neighborhood. Many of this group again met for lunch as a subcommittee is getting to a point with some draft recommendations. At Robert's request, he spoke to DRAC at the August meeting to express his concerns with demolitions to the full committee. This may have been the first time, at least in recent memory, that an outside speaker not affiliated with the city has formally spoken as scheduled guest speaker at DRAC. Additionally, his request, I spoke to Southeast Uplift's Board of Directors meeting in August regarding demolitions. Personally, I've attended with Mary Helen a Rose City Neighbor Association meeting, discussed the draft ordinance, attended the demolition forum held in late June at Concordia College, and have made numerous updates to the building industry through the infill builders meetings held monthly at First American Title and to various meetings at the Home Builders Association. Mary Helen will probably update you on the more numerous meetings she has attended with neighborhood and other organizations. We've really tried to make an outreach, is what I'm trying to get to. Here's my view of what DRAC has accomplished on the two sides. The building industry has given up the K-1 exemption that allowed a replacement dwelling immediately after demolition of a structure if the new structure was permitted. According to BDS records, that exemption was used over 74% of the time between May of 2013 and November of this year. The industry will now face a 35-day delay on all demolitions. The remodeling branch of the industry will now have a 35-day notice and possible delay for any major remodel over 50% of the structure where they had none before. The neighbors gain information and assurances that local neighbors and neighborhood organizations affected will be notified about any major remodel or demolition that has a reasonable time frame to attempt to negotiate a purchase or relocation of a historic or important property that can be negotiated. There is a method to extend negotiation time for the party is available. What has not been mentioned, and I guess Nancy has mentioned, that 30-day extension can go as long as those parties want to negotiate. Education, Nancy touched on this some. We're going to work to make sure that everybody involved in the demolition process is informed and educated. One of the major concerns we hear from the neighbors are concerns over asbestos and lead poisoning. It's a valid concern, and one thing that all of us involved in the committee, from staff to builders to citizens, came to understand is the complexity of the authority between EPA, DEQ, Oregon Health Authority, OSHA, and the Oregon Construction Contractors Board on who, what, and how it's monitored. The Portland Home Builders Association of First Americans Infill Builder Group have already had Chris Zimmer of OSHA address builders on some of the issues. Chris also attended at least two subcommittee meetings to provide information, as did Audrey O'Brien of Oregon DEQ. Education will be an ongoing issue with DRAC, BDS, and the industry, which we need to follow up on. Are both sides happy? Definitely not. I know you're going to hear testimony from some people who want to keep the 120-day rule, even though it's not been used effectively. Are builders and remodelers happy? Again, definitely not. I've been in the crosshairs of several that think our industry's given up too much. But I personally feel that DRAC has found a relatively even solution to a complex question. I suggest the City Council adopts this resolution that a time frame of 12 to 18 months be included to allow DRAC and BDS to monitor the results and at some point report back to City Council any recommendations to tweak the process if needed. Too often ordinances don't get reviewed until problems flare up. I would hope DRAC would be allowed to and be required to come back and report on how the solution adopted has been working. I want to make a couple other comments before I move on. On the deconstruction issue, I fought that, as DRAC chairman, I fought that in the subcommittees pretty hard because one of the suggestions came across that we reduce the notification to neighbors down to 14 days if they deconstruct. I didn't feel that protected the neighbors, first of all. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't want to be perceived as supporting something that took away some time frame from the neighbors as a builder representing DRAC and chairing DRAC. And I've told Sean Wood from BPS that I'd be more than happy to sit on any committee. I think there's merit to it. I just didn't feel that we could get anything done on this project if we mixed that in, as Nancy mentioned to earlier. I also think that maybe at some point in time, the neighborhoods might want to try to do an inventory of buildings they really feel they ought to preserve in their neighborhood so that when notice comes that somebody's demoing something that's kind of higher on their priority. Yes, this house is important to us. We've already kind of thought about it. We want to move into saving it. And house B over here doesn't have any really qualities that we'd want to fight to preserve. So I would like to see the neighbors maybe pick up on that. Finally, I got to recognize people involved in this process to all, first of all the great BDS staff that worked with the subcommittee, whether it's permitting, codes, inspection services, or management. They were all invaluable in finding out information and making suggestions on solutions for the committee. To the neighborhood and neighborhood organizations that attended meetings and participated, to Robert McCulloch and Ann Dufay of Southeast Uplift and Tamara DeRider of Rose City Neighborhood Association, Rick Mickelson, past DRAC member, and John Hassenberg, an active DRAC meeting participant, along with Audrey O'Brien, Oregon DEQ's asbestos manager, and Chris Zimmer. Additionally, Claire Carter, DRAC's Neighborhood Coalition Land Use Committee member, was willing to find time from her busy schedule to meet with Mary Helen and myself over coffee several times one-on-one to find solutions both sides could live with. Rob Humphrey, DRAC member and owner of Faster Permits Permitting Service, often saw problems from the permit side of an issue that it might affect the city or the applicant. He was really invaluable to say, hey, wait a minute, this is going to cause a problem for one side or the other. The last two people were most important to the process. Kudos must go to Nancy for keeping the subcommittee group on focus and for the most part on time, and that was tough on occasions. Her meeting management skills were a must to try to accomplish the goals each meeting needed to accomplish, with so many of us wanting to go different directions and with so much input from all parties, including staff. Of course, you don't have a completed process until you have someone like her writing the code ordinance. Last but not least, Mary Helen Kincaid. This lady is fabulous. She jumps in with both feet and is a major reason this process got completed. I'll let her update you on the number of meetings she attended, but I can tell you the number of times I got an email at close to midnight because she just got home from a neighborhood meeting, whether it was involving DRAC and demolitions or some other city committees, she's on or was serving on. City of Portland, as a citizen of the year, I nominate her. Other citizens might be somewhat worthy of the award, but they have not outworked her. I would look forward to her becoming chair of DRAC next month for the energy and excellent skill she brings to the project. She really did dive in on this, and she held all of our feet to the fire. It didn't matter if it was my side of the industry. I imagine Nancy would agree to me some degree. She did a really fabulous job of keeping everybody informed and everybody up to date. So,
thank you.
Mayor, I have a
questions.
Quick please. Question. Yeah. Jeff, the mayor talked about the sort of front door, back door, and posed a big philosophical question. One issue that we're not going to really take up today, but I'd like your opinion on, is what's the new owner's obligation in terms of maintaining a house and the property that is subject to demolition, but maybe months and months off?
Well, his obligation is to keep the house secured, keep the grass mowed and, you know, kept up, stuff like that, keep the garbage out and that kind of thing. And that's where some of us had problems. We did a project out in the Kenton area a couple of years ago where we had, because we were in a design area, we had to notify everybody. We had somebody build a fire in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Luckily, it was built on a sheet of tin, so it didn't burn the house down. But there's been other projects in the mail, in the paper, where people were squatting on a project and stuff like that. So it's the responsibility of that person that owns the property to keep it up and keep it secure.
So I'm glad you said that those are all the obligations, because there's a house on my block. In fact, it's next door, that apparently is slated for demolition. And initially, there was a sign out front, and they took that down. But I've noticed that almost everybody is using it as the bathroom for their animals. The lawn is not being mowed. And I'm starting to see periodically someone come and put up, use wood to cover openings or holes or other kinds of things. And I don't know whether that's because people are trying to get in and squat. But I hope it's well understood to folks that buy these properties and intend to demolish it that they do have to be good neighbors up until the time they take them down and maintain them. Otherwise, they really become attractive nuisances.
Right.
And a lot of bad things can happen. And frankly, one of the things I've started thinking about is, what if someone broke in, was in there, you know, used the fireplace, it caught on fire. My house is right next door. I mean, how do we make sure that bad things don't happen to the neighbors with essentially an abandoned house?
Yeah, what the code did require was people post a big orange notice on the front door, and that's what was drawing transients in. And I'm not that familiar with the state law, but I know if they become squatters, they have some legal rights to stay in the project. So that's one reason we wanted to take those notices off, notify the neighbors. And the reason we picked the door hanger, we rather than posting it on a telephone post or something, we thought that a transient in the neighborhood might recognize that door hanger to be some advertising from the carpet cleaning guy or, you know, the Girl Scouts or whatever, and wouldn't pay attention to it, yet it'd also be placed on somebody's door so they would see it and know that there was going to be something happening. We really wanted, at least I did, and some of the other people involved really wanted to take that notice to transients away so that not only were we not affected as developers, but the neighbors didn't have, as you stated, somebody next door that might burn the house down and damage their property or destroy their property.
Thank you.
Can I ask about the 150-foot rule? I think a normal block is 200 feet, so I'm just wondering what the rationale was for saying that notice will only extend 150 feet from the house in question.
That was basically taken from from Title 33, because there was already a provision in the code for that, so we just mirrored that.
The intent was to mirror it, Commissioner, similar to the land use notification. So not only were the customers coming to BDS having to remember, okay, is it 150 on this one and 200 on another one? Staff didn't have to remember. So we tried to mirror it so it was an easy, knowledgeable thing.
Gotcha. I should have realized that. Now, over the years, have we gotten in recent months, have we gotten feedback on 150 feet? Do people think that that's adequate?
Have we gotten feedback on...
Feedback from, you know, neighbors of houses that have been or are proposed to be demolished, saying that they think that the notice should extend beyond 150 feet to like a full block or two blocks or something?
I haven't received any comment that they didn't think that was adequate. Part of the thing is we're adding, you know, we're recommending adding this mailed notice that doesn't exist right now. So it's... you know, making the notice a lot more effective, we think.
There was nothing in the past, but I do remember there was one citizen that was at one of our meetings that suggested we go four blocks. We thought that was a little far, personally, but...
Okay, other questions? Do you have anything else you want to add? So
just I just want to thank Mr. Fish, especially for reminding me about the need for the report back. I can't believe I missed that. So I'm going to have a friendly amendment to my own ordinance here, and that is to add a number 12 that will say BDS is directed to continue working with DRAC on this issue and to bring a report to council by June 30th of 2016, providing an assessment on the outcomes of these code changes.
Okay, I'll take that as a motion. Is there a second?
2016?
Yes. But that's a year to get the data and then a little bit beyond that. This won't go into effect until, February now, because we'll be voting on it after right. Christmas.
Right.
Yeah, it's coming right up, 2016.
Yeah. Okay, there's a motion that seconded. Any further discussion? So we'll take a vote on that. So that's what's in front of the council. So to adopt that amendment.
Who seconded?
Dan did.
Okay. Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thank you. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Thank you.
I think that Mary Helen and a few other people wanted to come up.
Yeah. Yes, please. So, Mary Helen, come on up.
I also wanted to introduce Chris Zimmer here. He's the senior investigator for the state OSHA, and he was going to speak just a little bit about their relationship.
Good, please.
Just bring up whoever you want.
Mr. McAuliffe, come on up with Mary Helen and Mr. Zimmer. Okay.
I'll do cleanup.
Well, we got three chairs,
so make yourself comfortable wherever you want.
Robert has to leave.
Okay.
Robert is happy to be back from Quebec, and I know you've seen enough of me recently that I'll be very quick. When I was talking to the regulatory panel in Quebec, I missed Joe. It was so much less exciting than our friendly Joe the Speaker. They were much more serious in Quebec than they are here. This is very brief. We are luckily blessed with some pretty good grassroots leadership in the community. Jeff, Mary Helen, Claire, Andrew Fay, and I had lunch several times. First lunch was early enough that I was still secretary of Southeast Uplift before I was unlucky enough to be elected president of Southeast Uplift. And right from the start, it was a business discussion. We knew we were entering a really grueling period of conflict. Over this period, East Moreland lost 100 trees. We like our trees. I've been known to hug our trees. We had a variety of issues. I was amused with the question of how far the notice should be, because we had zero notice. And frankly, I would get calls at 7 in the morning saying there's a bulldozer knocking down the house next to me. What's happening? We've addressed all of those issues and very, very well. And I don't think Mary Helen's been praised enough. I have asked her to marry me, but unfortunately Presbyterians are not allowed to have harems.
I'm sorry, put that on the record.
And those of you who know my wife knows that this would be a suicidal moment.
Oni does have a mediation section that we can get
her husband
you
is in. A Navy veteran. I wouldn't
get
advise.
You both into
So, bottom line is the following. This is progress. I have raised the exact code language with our land use committee, the formidable Rod Merrick. Those of you who met him know to fear him. And also with Bob Kellett at Southeast Uplift. We'll have some changes. This is an evolving process. And Jeff's proposal to have a revisit is a good one. I would endorse that. There's a lot of debate about the 120-day delay. If used as a club, it was not effective. It was used as a negotiating period, it might be. But where it was until this moment was not effective. And we know that people found loopholes in it. And so there'll be a lot of debate here from people we represent and our allies. LLS worked very hard on this issue, has positions slightly more extreme than Southeast Uplift, but we actually like Gail Ellis, and we think he should be listened to very carefully. And I said, if you want to bang on me for saying that this is a pretty good step, feel free, and some of them may. So from Southeast Uplift and people who have worked their tails off on this, I think that Jeff and Claire and Mary Helen have done an excellent job. And we will probably come back. There will be fine-tuning. And let me take just one sentence on your comment about the relationship between the comprehensive plan and demolitions. Obviously, the comprehensive plan is the key. That's what the foundation is. We haven't got a very good idea of how the city works. A big issue in East Moreland is that the underlying plot lines from the turn of the last century became buildable without really anyone's notice. So suddenly the house you thought was on a street of 50 by 100 lots, instantaneously became 25 by 100 lots. Well, if you have an investment in that, and you might, you're pretty upset. So there are a lot of comprehensive plan issues that are important. We are addressing them. We want to maintain that single family operational neighborhood feel of Portland. That's actually very central to our character. And so we will be revisiting that with you, and we will take it very seriously. And believe it or not, I'm going to shut up and leave. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for participating in this whole process.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
My name is Claire Carter. I'm at 6156 Southwest Nevada Court. I am one of two neighborhood representatives on the DRAC, Mary Helen Kincaid being the other one. I'm here in support of the DRAC's proposed development code amendments to address changed circumstances related to how residential demolitions are allowed in the city and to answer any questions the City Council may have related to the proposed code changes, if I can, although probably Ms. Thorington is a much better authority than I am. I truly appreciate Mayor Hale's perspective about the demolition process, and I believe that our proposal is to address the issues is the best that BDS and the DRAC can do under our current authority. Thank you very much. I would like to add some additional information or just to make a statement about the 120-day demolition review, which is currently allowed in the city code. I want to emphasize that city neighborhoods have few tools to address what might be built in their neighborhoods. While the city's land use codes all have some level of notification of neighborhood associations as part of their land use process, the neighborhoods have few tools to actually address concerns or issues related to the actual form residential development would take. The 120-day delay currently associated with residential demolition has frequently been used by the neighbors and neighborhoods to express frustration and anger about the lack of meaningful opportunities for neighborhoods to weigh in on new residential development. It is the only tool that can be used to address properties with cultural significance, since property rights, who owns a property, trumps the community interests in individual properties, as I think we all understand. The proposed 35-day demolition notification and the additional 30-day waiting period provides a minimal amount of time for business organizations, neighborhood associations, and historical societies to contact a property owner to discuss demolition alternatives. The current 120-day delay can be a significant financial issue for property owners waiting to develop, during which time the developer must continue to pay on loans or financial instruments. There is no requirement for evidence of progress toward a realistic demolition alternative on the part of those proposing the 120-day delay. While 65 days after hearing of a proposed demolition is not a lot of time to develop a proposal, this provides a small window to assess possibilities and develop or attempt to develop a relationship with the property owner. I would especially like to emphasize the 30-day waiting period after the initial 35-day notification does not require that a plan is in place and has been executed. It is additional time for interested parties to explore options, to determine if a property owner is willing to consider options, and may allow the parameters of negotiation to be determined. While, you know, we have as little as 24 hours to respond to a proposal to buy a property in the private sector, that amount of time frequently in the volunteer and neighborhood sector is not possible, since neighborhoods are volunteer organizations. There are many different circumstances that affect their receiving a notice and their ability to actually mobilize interested parties in their neighborhood. I think the current 120-day delay is a significant financial consideration for a property owner to deal with. I think the current proposal, which is a 35-day notification with the potential for a 30-day window extension, would allow the intent of the existing 120-day delay to remain while requiring that organizations not drag their feet in contacting a property owner and moving towards developing a plan to an alternative to destroying what might be an important community resource. I think the process that we've used to develop this proposal has been phenomenal. Members of the DRAC stepped up. They added their time. They contributed their time, as Robert, as Jeff Fish, and as Mary Helen would probably tell you,